summer break, and it's nice just sometimes to veg out and look at a movie. I'm thinking of like the movie, one of the Transformers movies. I probably watched a couple of more parts of them. That's one nice thing about on Hulu or you know, on the TV coming through the internet. You can pause it. You can walk away from it. It'll be on again. You don't have to. It doesn't have to own you. But I'm thinking of, you know, the hero, like maybe it's Optimus Prime or some other character in one of these movies, and they get delivered some real hard punch, and maybe they're down, and maybe they're trying to get up and processing what they, and just another, some sort of a strike hits them. And of course, you know, these feel-good movies where the, in the end, right, they win. How about you and I? Have you ever been hit with something really difficult, seemed like it was out of the blue, and maybe, okay, you begin to process that, you begin to wrap your mind around it, you begin to think through how to pick up whatever pieces have fallen, and bam, another blow. It might be health, might be in relationships, it might be any of a number of different things. You know, it's conflict with people in the neighborhood, or and likely we've experienced something that we think might fit into that picture, and we can go back and think about how that felt. I've been reading through scriptures again on my sort of my own schedule, not following any particular plan, but Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. And so now I come to Job. And in the biblical book of Job, we encounter a man in crisis. He experiences just devastating blow, and then very little recovery time, the way the story is brought to us. He experiences the anguish of loss. He experiences physical pain. He experiences emotional pain. I appreciated the opening prayer with that mentions of several of these physical, spiritual struggles, emotional struggles. Job experiences a crisis of faith. Is God just? Is he not just? And as we go through the book of Job, the book chronicles his internal struggles and also his interactions with his wife and with some of his friends or those who came to be with him in his time of great duress. Why is Job included in the Bible? Why is it there? What does it have to teach us? What does it contain that we can add to our spiritual arsenal? Because of course, as we know, our battles are against spiritual forces, and the warfare is fought in our mind, it's fought in our heart, it's fought in can we live in peace? Can we, when we're disrupted out of that peace, can we, with God's help and the help of one another, find our way back to that peace? Today we're going to look into one particular aspect of something important to learn from the book of Job. And I've entitled this message, Caring for the Broken. Job, in several ways, was a broken man by what he underwent, what was just put on his plate. He had no control over it. He didn't cause it. But it's life. It's your life. He had to deal with it. Let's turn over to John chapter 16. We'll be spending quite a bit of the time in Job, but we'll go a little bit afield. Let's take a look in John chapter 16. Again, we're not strangers to setbacks. some of us have been raised in an environment where perhaps we were taught great skills at bouncing back from one thing, bouncing back from another thing. And some of us perhaps were raised in other environments where those skills were not taught or were not, you know, easily picked up on. In John chapter 16 and verse 33, this, I think, needs to sort of underlie the whole topic. And as I began, I mentioned peace. And peace is a fruit of living God's way. Peace is an after effect of our attempts, our devotion, our choosing God and His ways. And Jesus says, I have spoken to you these things that in me you might have peace. Of course, there's no better source of peace. There's no other source of true, actual, literal peace that guards us, that can temper us against events that might seek to shake us. He says, in the world you will have tribulation. This is a world. People hurt one another. Accidents happen. People say stuff. Not everybody's nice and warm and fuzzy. In the world you will have tribulation. But be of good cheer. In other words, come back to peace. Because he says, I have overcome the world. You and I have been called, we've been chosen, we have taken on the name of Jesus the Christ as preparing to be his bride. And life, however, is bound to bring us into conflict with the world. I recently watched an episode of The Chosen where Jesus made the clay and he put it on the blind individual's eyes, and that was a very moving, I thought, depiction of that. And then I included certain aspects of that in my notes, and then driving in today, I turned around and found a sermonizer on the radio, and he was also talking about this same event where Jesus is doing a good deed. Jesus is showing his power. Jesus is exhibiting love, compassion, kindness, concern. And yet, according to the leaders around him, he was doing it wrong. So, brethren, you and I, as we live this life according to God's way, it's bound that it's going to bring us into conflict with the world. But we can't lose sight of who's in our corner. Right, as we read in the first verse, Jesus said, be of good cheer. I have overcome the world, and it's not implicitly said in that verse, but he says, and I'm with you the whole way. We know that's elsewhere in Scripture. Much in the same way that when all the disciples fled, and you couldn't see anyone standing near Jesus, he wasn't alone. He was not alone. Let's go ahead and turn over to Job in the first chapter. If you're one of the people who likes to use that little black ribbon or red ribbon, that might be a good spot for it. I use it in my study Bible that I read in the mornings, but I don't usually bust it out in this particular copy. Job chapter 1 and verse 1. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was perfect and upright. Commentators have pointed out that this person was not living in Israel. And it may have been before the time of David or before the time of Abraham. Or it may have been contemporaries. We don't have those details. But he was not living in the promised land. But it says he was perfect and he was upright. Meaning, there was nothing he could be charged with. He couldn't be taken to the city gates and said, this man did A, B, or C. And he was also one who feared God and who tried to actively steer clear of evil. And there were born unto him 7 sons and 3 daughters. And he had all of this great substance, a very great household, it says in verse 3. So that this man was very prominent, probably was held in very high esteem. Now, what must the life have been like for Job? Well, got the kids, got the wife, got the sheep, got the land, got the servants, got the... It probably felt like things are going pretty smoothly. Have you ever felt like your life was going smoothly? Have you ever maybe felt like your life was going too smoothly? I know I thought at a time or two, wait a second, I'm supposed to have tribulation. Why are things so smooth? Am I really as close to God as I think I am? Or do I need to ponder and pray and think on and read and... God, I'm sure there's things I need to learn. You know, it's like patience. I was told years ago, don't ask for patience. Don't ask God, teach me what I need to learn. But I think we've talked before about at some point you've got to screw up your courage. And what am I missing? So I'm going to think that Job would have thought his life was going pretty smoothly. Well, and if your life is in one of those smooth periods, fantastic. I'm happy for you. But while one person is experiencing very, very smooth sailing, specifically if that's me in experiencing very smooth sailing, can I have a tendency maybe to look out at somebody whose life seems to be in a hurricane and gale force winds and think, I wonder why that is? Can we have a tendency to wonder why others seem to not be experiencing that peace? Let's turn over to John chapter 9 and we'll take a look at that story that I referenced. Jesus is out and about in the city and it's the Sabbath day. Chapter 9 of the book of John, verse 1, Jesus passed by. He saw a man who had been blind from birth. So he had never seen anything. He wasn't injured in an accident or anything like that, because the body, as designed by our Creator, is fantastic, and you can have a paralysis and the new pathways can be knit together by the body and feeling comes back, or you can have a memory lost and or some part of the brain is injured and tasks will, because of the way God designed it, they'll be shifted elsewhere in the brain and you'll get some of that functionality back. So again, you know, if a person could be sighted and then they could become blind in an accident, and maybe that optic nerve, maybe the systems recover. But this man had been blind from his birth. And Jesus' disciples, who were taught by whom originally? Well, they were taught by the Pharisees, and they were taught by the religious leaders, and they were taught this sort of health and wealth gospel. Well, if you just do right, you're going to be blessed, things are going to be great. And so to them it was a very logical question that they asked in verse 2. His disciples asked him, saying, Master, I know somebody sinned for this person to have been born blind. Was it him? I don't know how it could be him. He was born blind. Did he sin in the womb? I'm not sure how that's accomplished. Or was it his parents? What was the reason? There must be a reason. This must be a penalty for some sin of some sort somewhere. Was it his grandparents? Born blind, again, well, it's got to be a punishment for something. So again, the first reaction of the disciples, was it compassion? Oh, Jesus, you can perform a miracle and you can do something unheard of. Was it concern? Master, this person has been blind for, and now he's this many years old. It says later on that he was of age, so I'm not exactly sure what number that would be, but quite a few years. Was their first thought concern? Was their first thought healing? No. It's as though their first thought was, let's figure out who we can wag our finger at. It's your fault, wasn't it? It's you, wasn't it? Again, their first teachers were the Pharisees, the rabbis. So, and they were still in the process of unlearning. Many of us came into the truth after having been of religion X or religion Y or religion Z, and we may have many things that we had to enter into a process of unlearning. In verse 16 of chapter 9, some of the Pharisees said, "The one who healed you is not of God, because he does not keep the Sabbath day." Others amongst the Pharisees said, "Well, how can a man that is a sinner do such miracles?" And so there was a division even among these leaders. And it's interesting to ponder why Jesus chose to stoop down and mix water and dirt on the ground and make a clay paste and put it on the eyes. And it seems reasonable that he was wanting to intentionally make a point of that even though the Pharisees considered that breaking the Sabbath, he was Lord of the Sabbath, and that was not breaking the Sabbath. There was a higher purpose to be served, and that was to restore the sight of this man. But again, the Pharisees, their first thought was, let's accuse. We don't want to lose our power. It's about us. Their thought was not the compassion that Jesus had shown, the healing, the... This man would now be able to support himself rather than sit and beg. In verse 30 of this same chapter, the Pharisees had been questioning this man. They said, "Well, how is it that you received your sight?" And he said, "Well, I already told you two times. You want to hear it a third time?" And they're trying to get him to denounce Jesus. But the man, verse 30, the man answered and said unto them, "Well, what an amazing thing that you don't know where Jesus is from, and yet he has performed this miracle. He's opened my eyes." The man continued, he said, "Now we know that God does not hear sinners, but if any man be a true worshiper of God and does his will, him he hears." Such powerful words. Again, we heard in the first message about hearing, drinking it in, turning that into action, doing, tremendous counter-argument to the faith without works argument. And again, verse 32, "Since the world began, was it not heard that any man opened the eyes of one born blind? If this man were not of God, he could do nothing." It's like this man, who hadn't seen until today, could see things more clearly than these great leaders and these power brokers. He was the one who could see the logic of it. And I've got to be amazed at the mind of this man who, though having been born blind, so therefore he certainly couldn't read, yet he must have drunk in what he heard and known the scriptures of God and had a mind and a heart to process those and to be able to answer back with this. Reminds me of a gentleman that we used to live in Phoenix East a couple decades back, and well, probably 3 decades back. And he had become blind later in life, and he could come up and give a sermon at no notes and quote the scriptures, and it's like he had some sort of visual memory of what he wanted to say. It was impressive. Seeing the real picture, not seeing what we've been sort of indoctrinated to believe, as the disciples had sort of been taught in their earlier years before Jesus began to exert his influence on them. But going back to Job chapter 1 and this question of why do challenging circumstances come upon people? Again, did this person sin? Did their parents sin? Why is this person who I read about in the announcements going through this trial? You know, what did they do? Who's to blame? Why do challenging circumstances come upon people? Is there only one answer? I'm a math guy. Is there some math formula you can figure out? Well, if you put these facts together, then you'll know exactly. No, there's no flow chart for that. Job chapter 1 and verse 5, that Job's children would have feasts, and they would go to each brother's home in turn, and they'd invite the sisters. And verse 5, when the days of their feasting were gone about, Job sent and sanctified them. I'd be interested to know exactly what that looked like. And rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job says, maybe my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. And this was Job's then normal course of action. Right? It's almost like he wanted to make sacrifices to pay off the debts that his children might have incurred. In 6 through 12 of chapter 1, we read a little bit about this interview, some have called it. Satan appears in the assembly of the angels at the throne of God, and gets permission to put Job to the test. The scene plays out in heaven. Satan, of course, wants to destroy Job, wants to make it so that he does curse God and die, as his wife will later say. What does God want? Well, God permitted this. In this world, you will have tribulation. God is willing in this scene. God is willing that Job is tested, is tried, and put to the test. And again, so we read some of these awful sounding things that we wouldn't ever want to. We would not want this person to rush into our house and stand in front of us and say, right? There was a day when his sons and his daughters, verse 13, were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house, and there came a messenger unto Job and said, right? All the oxen are gone. All the asses are gone. Stolen away by a marauding band. And I, the only one. Everybody else was killed. I'm the only one who got away. And I made it out by the skin of my teeth so I could bring you this news. Boom. Punch in the jaw. Begin to think about, what would you do if that was the only message you got that day? That would be difficult. God, why me? I thought we were good. While he was yet speaking, verse 16, there came another. Hey, guess what? Lightning. Or some fire from heaven has burned up all the sheep and the servants. And they're gone too. Completely gone. And I alone am escaped to tell you. Bam. Another hard blow. And again, maybe you can think of a time when you had some really hard news of whatever sort. And maybe you can think, wow, God, I haven't even got up on my feet yet. And boom, another just challenging, unthinkable, unfathomable. Why? Why would this happen? How could this happen? Especially with the light, the fire of God is fallen from heaven. We said is how it's related in verse 16. So, in other words, you can attribute this, the donkeys being stolen, to the Sabaeans, but we're going to attribute the sheep and your servants who are with the sheep to the action of God. Verse 17, while he was yet speaking, there came another and said, the camels, they've all been stolen away. And all those servants of yours who were with the camels, dead, except for me. And while he was still speaking, the cruelest blow of the four, your sons and daughters, the house fell on them. They're dead. The servants are dead. I barely squeaked out and have brought you this news. Now, when we read these words of Job starting in verse 21, we think, really? Could anybody have that kind of composure? Could anybody say these words in what sounds like a passionless tone? Was Job as emotional as this sounds? In verse 20 it says Job stood up, he tore his clothes. That was a ceremonial thing. It could certainly be done with emotion. It could also be done just ceremonially because that's what's done. He shaved his head and he fell down upon the ground and he worshiped. And he said, naked did I come out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Again, I ask the question, was Job as unemotional as this sounds? And an even more important point than that is, who am I to judge how one person processes their grief? Who am I to say, well, that's not what he should have done. He should feel differently. He should feel more strongly. He should... Right? Who is any of us who's not in the situation to judge how that other person processes the situation? Now, of course, we go into chapter 2 and we see there's another audience at God's court in heaven, and Satan receives permission to further abuse or put pressure on Job, this time to take his health away. And so that second wave of trial starts in chapter 2 and verse 7. In verse 9, so Job is covered with boils. I won't describe boils. I don't want boils. He's covered in sore boils, not just boils. Awful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, to where the only relief is, I'm just going to take this broken piece of clay pot and sit down in the ashes and try to relieve some of this discomfort. And verse 9, his wife said unto him, do you still retain your integrity? Curse God and die. Now, Job's wife usually gets judged pretty harshly for this. I try to sort of put myself in her situation. If you were Job's wife, what might be on your mind? Well, now I have at times been asked by one person or another, why aren't you more upset about that? Or how come you're so calm about that? Or, you know, was she mad at Job? Was Job taking it with too much dignity and reserve or something like that? It seemed to her, and maybe to Job, that all of the sacrificing he had done, all of the worshiping he had done, had been for nothing. That's visibly, that's what it might look like. Do we forget that Job's wife was suffering immense loss too? Right? She had been the wife of the sultan, or whatever term you might want to use, the caliph, the most influential man. I think of 10 pregnancies, 90 months worth of pregnancy in bringing these 10 children forth. Poof, gone. Years of teaching them, training them, loving them, nurturing them. Poof, gone. Oh, I can't wait till my old age. I'll be surrounded with scads of grandkids. Poof, gone. Who am I to say? Job's wife. Mrs. Job, you're a terrible person. You shouldn't have said that. Now, is there something to be said? Yeah. Is there perhaps some wise and loving thing to say? Yeah, probably. But we don't really know what she was going through. We don't really know what our brother, our sister in a trial is going through, even if we've had something we might think is similar ourselves. Chapter 2, verse 11. We have three characters introduced here. Chapter 2, verse 11. And they have come. Job's three friends heard of all this, you know, bad circumstances that had come upon him. And they each came from their own place. This Temanite probably indicates the town that he came from, which was apparently a town that was noted for wisdom. And then Bildad the Shuhite from some other town, Shua or some such. And Zophar the Naamathite. For they had arranged with one another to come together to then go and meet Job and to console, to mourn, it says, with him and to comfort him. Those are great goals. Those are great goals. And as we read through, which we won't look very much into the various speeches of these, actually we won't touch on them but much at all, we can see things that were right and yet was it the right time to say them. We can see things that were wrong and at the wrong time. We can see things that were arrogant. We can see things that were meant to comfort. And yet, if you can put yourself back in that time when you were under some sort of hard stress, how much did you want to hear platitudes like, oh, it'll get better. Oh, cheer up. You know, oh, it'll be, you know, give it time. Well, those are true. It probably will get better. And if you give it time, but platitudes. So they wanted to mourn with him. That's a pretty great sacrifice to make. And they wanted to comfort him, it says in verse 11. But as they were coming towards him, in verse 12, while they were still yet quite a ways off, they look over there and they couldn't even recognize him. He's sitting in ashes, right? He's not dressed up in his finery. And they wept, and they tore each one of them his outer garment, and they sprinkled dust upon their heads toward heaven. Very good of them to come and weep with Job. They saw his signs of mourning, and they mirrored those. They tore the garment, they threw the dust on the head, the dust in the air, and you know it lands in the head. Try to commiserate is a good word. Verse 13, so they sat down with him upon the ground 7 days and seven nights. Again, they must have been devoted. They must have meant well. They must have thought that they were there and it was going to produce a good result. And in the end of this encounter, however long it takes, there will be some sort of improvement all around. And none spoke a word unto him. And if the story ended there, it might be better, right? If the story ended there, they didn't say a word. They just sat with him. Hey, I'm here with you. Right, their presence saying, in effect, I'm here for you. I'm here with you. I'm wearing these sackcloth or whatever it might be, and I'm just here to support you. That was great. They showed up. They didn't fill the air with platitudes. They sat and they commiserated with him. They probably continued to weep with him. For they saw, verse 13 ends, for they saw that his grief was very great. The presence of a friend can be such a positive thing, such a strong thing, such a salve, an ointment, a curative. Sometimes talking spoils it. Sometimes talking, depending on a number of factors. Let's move on to Job chapter 3. Entire chapter 3, 26 verses, Job is venting. He's venting his despair. Why was I even born? Why was I born? Why? Right? He says, if I would have been dead, if I would have just been stillborn, there's no grief in the grave, there's no torment. We might have heard that ranting of Job in chapter 3. We might have said, how dare he? How dare he say that God brought him out into this world for no purpose? People in deep grief cry out in anguish of heart. Should they be scolded? Will a logical argument snap them out of it? Well, you know, you still have, you're still pretty young. You could probably recover your wealth. You could probably have more kids. Would that cheer you up? It's logical, right? It's logical and it's true and it's something positive. So, see, I should say that because it's logical. And I'm very much closer to logic than I am to emotion, shall I say? I tend to be on the thinking angle end of the spectrum as opposed to more toward the feeling end. I pray I'm improving at that, but right, I can be logical all day. And I can be logical to that person who's in emotional turmoil, and they are going to say, will you please get away from me? Will you please take yourself elsewhere? Because it's going to sound like just nails on a chalkboard. Again, the presence of a friend can be great. Sometimes talking spoils it. Job's friends give very long and elaborate discourses, and they bloviate and profess this knowledge of how the universe works. We don't have to wonder if they were out of line, because God says they were towards the end of the book, doesn't he? God says, you need to go to Job and ask him to sacrifice on your behalf. So God, I'll just go over here to chapter 42 and verse 7. Again, if Job really had been the wicked sinner that they said, well, Job, this can't have happened for nothing. There must be some secret sin. Maybe you forgot about it. Maybe there's this thing you did back when and you've forgotten about it. Or, you know, maybe you're really just a stinker and you just put on this good show and a good front. Chapter 42 of Job in verse 7, just following Job's statement of repentance. Verse 7, it was so that after the Lord had spoken these words to Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz, who was maybe the spokesperson of these three, my wrath is kindled against you and against your two friends, for you have not spoken of me right, as my servant Job has. And then he instructs them to take these several animals to my servant Job and offer, and he will offer up for you a burnt offering. And my servant Job shall pray for you. For him will I accept. So, again, these people, very similarly to the Pharisees, Eliphaz and Bildad and what's his name, they thought, well, I know how things work. There's a bad thing happens, well, it's because there was a sin over here. Just like the Pharisees and even Jesus' disciples in their early development thought. And of course, in the Ten Commandments, we read that the sins of the parents continue down generations of those who don't follow the law of God. And oftentimes bad habits learned from parents, grandparents, others trickle down, and they affect our lives and they affect what some of the outcomes that we experience. And it's not some little formula. If bad outcome, then sin. Cut and dried. Don't have to think about it. No, God held them to account for their strong words. They had spoken very authoritatively. So, good news. Job processed his grief. Job got it. How? What happened? How is it that Job came to process through his grief? Well, as we know, it was when God entered the conversation. We can read chapters 38 through 41. We can see the concept of God questioning Job and where were you when? Have you ever told somebody who's grieving about something, God's got this? I probably have. It sounds good. Is it one of those platitudes? Well, perhaps. I'll let you ponder that. But as I ask myself, have I ever told a grieving friend, God's got this? That maybe I'm the one who needs to think about that statement. God's got this. God had Job. God didn't leave the picture and go off and play golf. God knows what you're going through. God knows what I'm going through. God knows what this, that, the other sister, brother is going through. I think of that poem, Footprints. I remember one of my pastors thought it was trite and silly and whatever. And okay, maybe. But I still think it's a pretty picture of the fact that God's got this. Maybe I'm the one who needs to think about the fact that God's got that suffering sister, that suffering brother in their hands and is working them through it. Eliphaz and his two friends might have known that God was at work with Job. They might have understood that God was bringing Job back into some kind of a balance. But they seemed to be too busy trying to be logical, too busy trying to... I like the turn of a phrase that I hear sometimes in talks about politics. And it's a phrase that says, are you more concerned with fixing the problem or fixing the blame for the problem? Because it's very human to want to point that finger. Isaiah chapter 53. I didn't even write down any specific verses in Isaiah chapter 53. Speaking of, in verse 3, Jesus, a prophecy of Jesus, he is despised and rejected of man, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. He's acquainted with grief. He experienced grief. He has seen your grief. He's seen my grief. He's acquainted with grief. We hid our faces from him. He was despised and we esteemed him not. Verse 4 of Isaiah 53, surely he has borne, he has carried our griefs. He was carrying Job. Again, making me think of that Footprints poem. He has carried our griefs, he's carried our sorrows, and yet when we see somebody stricken, as verse 4 mentions, when we see somebody smitten, we think, must not be close with God, must not be right with God. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him. And with his stripes we are healed. Let's turn over to Hebrews chapter 4. Hebrews 4 and verse 14, seeing then that we have a great high priest that is passed into the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our profession. Hold fast our integrity, as Job's wife made mention. Do you still hold fast your integrity? We ought to. Our perfect high priest. For we do not have a high priest, verse 15, who cannot be touched, right? Who cannot feel with compassion. with the feeling of our infirmities, but he was in all points tested, just like us. Yet he endured all these tests without sin. He experienced the full gamut of humanity. He was tested. All right, we know those certain tests before he began his public ministry, and certainly tested throughout in other ways. Verse 16, he says, "Let us therefore come boldly unto the throne of grace." How come boldly? Well, because God has compassion. Our high priest has compassion. They know what we're going through. They've been tested. They know how hard it is for us humans to resist. So he says, "Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need." We, of course, want to seek God's grace. We want to seek that forgiveness, that relationship. But we also want, I hope, and I'm sure that it's true, that we also want to seek to be distributors of that grace. That grace comes to me through God. It comes to you through God. And we then can distribute that to our brother in their time of weakness. We can show that mercy and that compassion. Luke chapter 19. Just one instance of Jesus' heartfelt concern demonstrated in his words. Luke chapter 19 and verse 41, it says that when Jesus had come near to Jerusalem, he looked down from where he was at the point and wept over the city, saying, "If you had known, even you, at least in this your day of visitation, your day, Jerusalem, of the Son of God being in your very midst to teach you the right things, the things which would have led to your peace, the things which belong to your peace. But now they are hid from your eyes." And then he speaks of the eventual and not very far off overthrow of the city, to be taken by enemies and everything disrupted and not one stone left upon another. Jesus felt deep grief. Grief that the people in Jerusalem were destined not to turn to God at that time. He could also see beyond that, of course, to the second resurrection, when there will be opportunity. Mark chapter 3 and verse 1. Jesus went into the synagogue, and there was a man there who had a withered hand. Again, Jesus knew that the Pharisees were going to look on any act of healing as a breaking of one of their 600 and some odd restrictions. Jesus wanted, he was going to bring out that. Maybe bringing out this, maybe putting it right in front of them and making them attack him. Maybe that would cause some of them to think beyond their training, beyond their indoctrination. Maybe it would cause some of the other people in the synagogue to stop and think, wait a second. He was going to gauge their hearts. He was going to work with them a little bit. Would they have compassion? Again, we didn't see compassion in the episode of healing the man who had been born blind. Would they have compassion this time, or would they say, nope, not allowed? And he said to the man with the withered hand, "Stand, come forward." And verse 4, he turned and asked the Pharisees a question, right? Which, is it compassion or is it strict rules? Which one is it? Verse 5, "And when Jesus had looked around about on them with anger, being grieved for the hardness of their hearts, he said unto the man, stretch your hand out." Which, of course, he couldn't do until Jesus said that. And he did stretch it out, and his hand was restored in great condition like the other. Their attitude caused him grief and anger. we know the verse, be angry and sin not. Of course, Jesus perfectly processed his anger, and he didn't sin because of who he was and because of all that he knew. You and I, of course, find ourselves far more challenged. Grief, loss, suffering, pain, they're baked into the human experience. Perhaps we know intellectually that everybody processes grief in their own individual way. Some people on the surface where we can see it, some people below the surface where we can't see it. Who am I to put my timetable on another person's grief? Well, this person lost a kid. That should take them approximately 2.2 years to, or, you know, this person, you know, make up another silly example to put our timetable on that. The ways in which each of us process the difficult events of this life, again, are informed by our childhood, what happened in our young adulthood, our upbringing, maybe where we went to church or who we hung out with or our teachers, who knows, how our parents and other family members reacted when they were under stress. And since each of us has had different past experiences, it's not a big surprise if we have different ways of processing, if my brother processes differently than perhaps I do. In Philippians chapter 1, I'm just going to read one verse, so don't necessarily need to turn there. The key, of course, is trusting God. God's got this. But again, not just cutesy-ootsy words that say, God's got this, but knowing that, believing that, having faith in God. The key is trusting that God is at work in each of our lives. Each of us has been called by God. The God of everything that exists, and he's not willing to let any of us fail in his calling. And so we read in Philippians 1 and verse 6, being confident of this very thing, that he who began a good work in you will perform it until the day of Christ Jesus, right? Or until the day you draw your last breath, or so what good things did those three friends do? Well, by which I want to ask, what can we do to assist in the healing process of our brother? Well, one thing we can do is offer help. But maybe before we do that, let's take a look at Psalm chapter 139 and just read a couple of verses there. Talking to a friend, and he was talking to me about some psychology stuff, which I take with a grain of salt, and yet, you know, you live long enough, you see certain things ring true in the behavior of yourself or of people around you. Our own motives are such a tricky thing. Psalm 139, verse 23, David says, search me, O God, and know my heart. And I might add, and tell me what you find. I think my motives are right. Are they really? Are my motives purely to help, or do I have some extra layer of selfish motives? Well, I want to be the one who helped, or I don't know what it might be. Show me, God. Right? Verse 23, search me, O God, and know my heart, and tell me what you find. Try me, and know my thoughts. And see if there is any wicked way in me. Because I might be oblivious and not realize it, not see it, not know it. And lead me in the way everlasting. So consider first your own motives. Ask God to prepare you to bring his encouragement. Again, to be instruments of God's grace, to be that one who, or to be a one who, because we don't need to be that one. Again, that kind of speaks to motive. Well, I want to be the one who turns this around and fixes this, and that's cool. But to be one who speaks God's words. So after we've perhaps done a little bit of searching inventory, we can offer help. Understand, though, that that person might not be in a place where they want to accept our help. Be okay with that. That person might very much appreciate what you're saying, and yet wherever they are in some spot, they're not ready to take you up on your offer. It's hard to be okay with that. But that would be a good thing. A second point, or maybe it's a third one if you include checking your motives. Offer to listen. Again, Job's three friends, they tore their mantles, they threw the dust in the air, and they sat and probably cried alongside. Very much an offer to listen on their part. Whether they said, even if they said, hey, feel free to tell us whatever you want to tell us, or right, you don't have to say that. You're there, you're a presence, you're a support, your intention is to be a support. And of course, offering to listen doesn't mean asking him 26 questions or prying or even, right, because in a sensitive time, a person might consider it to be prying, whereas perhaps your intention is nothing of the sort. But again, offer to listen. Let that person know that you are available if and when they would care to share. And then the last one I wrote is speak sparingly and caringly. And in terms of caringly, that might be carefully too, right? We ask God, hey, Father, I'm not very bright. At least I've been known to say that. And I could really use your help that I don't put my foot in my mouth, but that I say words that will represent you well. Speak sparingly and caringly. There are no perfect phrases. There are no, hey, you know what? I said this to a person one time and the whole situation was cured immediately. But there are perfectly bad things to say. Let me read this quote. Your words will not instantly cure your brother's situation, though the wrong words might instantly make it worse. Proverbs 25:11 speaks of a word fitly spoken, and what a beautiful thing it is. Proverbs 25:11, again, it talks about a word fitly spoken, you know, talks about pictures of silver and frames of gold. And a fitting word, which means spoken at the fitting time, right? Something that you feel like saying right now might be a great thing to say, but maybe the time to say it is after you've heard them talking for 2 hours. Or not that we should pre-decide what we're going to say and then listen, because of course we want to be more focused on the individual in need than ourselves. But a fitting word spoken at a fitting time. I thought a lot recently about greetings we give to people. You know, somebody walks in and you say, how are you doing? And I forget who it was that was talking about. In other countries, they know that if you ask an American that if an American asks, how are you doing? They don't want to hear an answer. They want to hear, fine, how are you doing? But right, if I come up and ask you, how are you doing? That can actually be a big fat stressor, depending on how you're doing. Right, if I'm in a turmoil because of this thing or because of that thing, and you ask me how I'm doing, then I gotta go. Okay, how much do I share with this person? Do they really care? Do I want to? And I've just, you know, thought of other things that maybe I would rather say to this person, like, hey, it's really great to see you. I'm so glad to see you today. And then, you know, allow that person to talk, especially if you know that they're hurting about something. Allow them to talk, see if they choose to share, if they in the moment feel safe. And again, even that whole concept of feeling safe. If someone doesn't feel safe talking to me at a particular moment in time, does that mean that they mistrust me, that they hate me, that they never have trust? No, it means that where they are at that moment, they're not feeling it. And the best thing I could do would be accept that and take what they have to give at the time. I will echo Randy's words and say, I love you. I know that we all desire for each and every one of us in the household of God to be successful in overcoming, to be successful in rising above the trials and rising above our own personal failings, to make it into the kingdom of God. We will be presented with opportunities to show God's grace, to show His kindness. What we do when we are presented with these opportunities will depend on how highly we esteem that brother. Right? Do I look at each one of you and say, that's a child of God? That's somebody God's gone to a lot of effort to work with and to call, and God would want me to be very careful? Or do I go all Bildad on you and say, well, obviously, you have to... It depends how highly we esteem that brother, and it depends on where our relationship with God is. Did I pray this morning? Well, if not, I might pop off with some answer or remark that doesn't help things. Brethren, opportunities. Life is just opportunity after the next of ways we can make a positive impact, ways we can let God in, let God help us out, let God form His Son's character in us. Let's resolve to do the work of being prepared to be agents of God's love and mercy. Let's be ready to extend His grace to His kids when they are at their lowest and are feeling broken.